From the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy, this is The Steady Stater, a podcast dedicated to discussing limits to growth in the steady state economy.
Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Brian Check, and our guest today is Dr. Sabine O'Hara. Sabine has master's and doctoral degrees from the University of Göttingen in the heart of Germany. She's parlayed these degrees into some highly creative steady state programs too, which we'll explore during the episode. But for starters, Sabine was the founding dean of CAUSES, yes, that's an acronym, at the University of the District of Columbia, or UDC. Now, CAUSES is the College of Agriculture, Urban Sustainability, and Environmental Sciences. Today, she directs a really innovative UDC program in urban leadership and entrepreneurship. Sabine has served as president of Roanoke College in Virginia, provost of Green Mountain College in Vermont, and president of the International Society for Ecological Economics. Sabine O'Hara, welcome to the Steady Stater.
Hi, Brian. Great to be here.
Thank you so much. Sabine, we like to get to know our guests a little bit at least, so let's see. Well, what part of Germany are you from, and was it your upbringing there that led you to an interest in ecological economics?
Well, I grew up in the southwestern part of Germany, a beautiful part of the country. It's also considered the entrepreneurial heart of Germany. The federal state is Baden-Württemberg, which for non-German native speakers is almost impossible to pronounce. So... yeah, I mean, my mother's side of the family had a background in farming, and so it's a beautiful area with small farms, rolling hill country. So yeah, I've always loved the outdoors, so I think that was my first introduction.
Yeah, it sounds really nice. Well, how about your research at the, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, the University of Göttingen. What was that about?
Well, this was the early days of environmental economics, Brian, and I really was, I received my doctoral degree in the agricultural economics department. I studied agriculture in my, what would here be considered undergrad, a lot of focus on science, and then, you know, fell in love with the social sciences. And at that point, agriculture and environment in many countries were sort of connected. Before we had agencies like EPA, it was a lot of times it was, you know, agriculture and environment. And so did my doctorate there in the early days on nitrate contamination of the groundwater through agricultural management practices. So, yeah.
Well, yeah. And Sabine, you've certainly held some prestigious positions. Dean, Executive Director, ISEE President. Which one would you say has been most conducive to advancing the steady state economy?
You know, I would say my current position as the Dean of the College of Agriculture, Urban Sustainability and Environmental Sciences, that was, you know, a newly formed college at the only public university in the nation's capital, and also the only exclusively urban land grant university in the nation. And so the opportunity to build this program and to connect both my research interests and my administrative experience, that just seemed too good to pass up. And so I started here in 2012 to build this college and now the new PhD program in urban leadership and entrepreneurship.
All right. Well, as a scholar and practitioner of ecological economics, what would you say is the biggest shortcoming of conventional or neoclassical economics?
Oh boy, Brian, there are a number. But one of the things that I find particularly problematic is, you know, we talk about resources in economics. We talk about using resources and labor inputs and so forth to convert them into useful goods and services. Of course, the first problem is that the telling name is externality for those unintended side effects of economic production. But I think more problematic even is the fact that we don't look at sinks. It's all about sources. And then the question becomes, okay, so where does it go? Where is it absorbed, buffered, and transformed? And that is completely out of the picture. And of course, I learned early on in my nitrate contamination research that this was a huge issue that is completely unconsidered in conventional economics.
Well, related to that, where would you say that shortcoming is most problematic? In our education system, the media, or the policy arena?
Well, I think all of the above, Brian. You know, thankfully, the work of the Club of Rome and then subsequently organizations like the International Society for Ecological Economics have drawn attention to the fact that we may well run out of resources. The Club of Rome, of course, was an early voice in that and said, be careful about how we use particularly those resources that are non-renewable. And so I think that was, you know, a welcome attention to that, the fact that we can't just keep growing and expect that there will not be any consequences and that we just can continue to do things as we've always done them. But attention to this problem of sink capacities has been lacking, really, both in education, in the media. There's just been very limited attention to that. And I would submit to you, Brian, that maybe we're running out of sink capacities faster than we're running out of resources.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds to me like that's a good segue to a particular theory of production that you have, which you wrote about in the Festschrift on Hermann Daly. Now, maybe I should probably mention that a Festschrift is simply a collection of writings published in honor of a scholar, in this case, Hermann Daly. Joshua Farley edited the Hermann Daly Festschrift, and it was published by the University of Vermont. And your chapter, Sabine, was called Production in Context, the Concept of Sustaining Production. Now, Sabine, you wrote, and bear with me, folks, as I read a fairly thick quote here. We'll break it down into smaller bites shortly. But Sabine, you wrote, a production process that maintains or enhances the underlying sustaining services that support its input flows and transformation capacity can be considered a sustaining production process that enhances the value of economic output. Now let's break this down into digestible bites for our listeners. First, what are the underlying sustaining services that support the production process?
Mm-hmm. And I really need to acknowledge Hermann Daly here, whose work I encountered when I was first in my graduate program, Brian. Immediately became intrigued with that. And actually, in the chapter that you reference in the Festschrift, I reference an experience that Hermann relates. Namely, he had intended to put a graph in a publication when he was at the World Bank, and that graph showed the economy as nested in society and culture and nested in the environment. And as he tells the story, the graphic, that figure that he had put in there to illustrate this nested systems idea, was promptly removed.
Mm-hmm.
And so then he, you know, resubmitted it, and I guess the end product was no graphic in that publication. Mm-hmm. And I think that story is very telling, and that's what I mean by traditional economics misses the context. Mm-hmm. Economics not a natural phenomena like gravity, right? It's a social system that we construct. It's an institution that we construct. And therefore, it is nested within society and culture. And we as human beings, in turn, are nested in what we call the environment or nature. And so it would behoove us to learn a few things about those social context systems and environmental systems as they relate to how we think about the economy.
Okay, so those underlying sustaining services that support the production process, are we talking about a mix of ecological services and social services, or were you primarily referring to ecosystem services there?
Yeah, I'm really referring to both the ecosystem services. But if you think a minute about this, I mean, ecosystem services refers to these absorptive capacities, buffering capacities of the environment. For example, forests that absorb carbon, or oceans that actually absorb more carbon than the forests. And, you know, in my early work on nitrates, we learned that there are certainly buffering capacities in that soil layer below the plant root zone, so the plants can't get at the nitrogen anymore. But a lot happens by the time the nitrogen actually shows up in the groundwater. And so as more and more of these emissions and waste is added, these absorbed capacities, of course, also are impacted. And in many cases, they lose their ability to absorb as much as they once did when these buffering capacities and absorptive capacities were still, very, very much available.
That's a great example. Well, what about the input flows and transformation capacity to be maintained? I think we can surmise now what the input flows are, land, labor, and capital, basically. But can you clarify for us the term transformation capacity?
Yeah, so let me use the example of labor, because I think that's the best one that illustrates that these sink capacities aren't just at work in the environment, but also in our communities, in our families, in these social systems, right? When you've worked, a 60, 70-hour week, Brian, you are tired. Mm. And without sufficient rest and some good food and maybe a good bottle of wine, right? And some company of friends, maybe you are a musician or like me, I love the outdoors. For me, being out in Rock Creek Park, which I'm fortunate enough is close to my house. So without those kinds of things, our labor capacity is exhausted. And if you don't get rest, if you don't get nurtured, you will not be as creative, as productive as you are when you are rested. And so these, what I call sink capacity or buffering capacity, are not only at work in nature, but they're also really important aspects of our human communities.
Mm-hmm. Now, finally, Sabine, what do you mean by enhances the value of economic output? Do you mean more stuff or better stuff?
Well, I really mean better stuff, not more stuff, right? Because if we have stuff that does more than provide the goods and services that we're looking for in our economic outputs, but if that stuff is also produced in a way that it, number one, lowers emissions and waste that are created in the production process, and then if we're really smart about that, maybe we can produce it in a way so that it also enhances these sink capacities, right? That would be sort of the ideal of a production process. In other words, you're paying attention to three things. You're paying attention to the quality of the product, you're paying attention to lowering emissions and waste, and you're paying attention to at least not burdening the sink capacities, and maybe even coming up with a way of doing things that will restore those sink capacities.
Excellent. All right, then. Well, what would you say are the most important policy implications stemming from this theory of production?
Oh, there are many, Brian. We've had, of course, a focus for some time now on emission reductions, although there is still not enough of that. And of course, we can have a big, long conversation about what policies might work better. But there has been very little focus on policies that would really pay attention to restoring sink capacities. And this is not just an environmental issue. As I said, this is also a social issue, right? Because we're expecting people to work longer and longer hours with fewer and fewer breaks and fewer vacations, and yet we expect them to be at their full productive capacity. And something has got to give. And we learned about something has actually given when we all found ourselves in this global pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic, and you see the number of women who have left the workforce because they have now, in a very real way, experienced this additional need to take care of the restorative, recreative needs of their families and communities. And historically, it's been women who have borne the brunt of providing these kinds of services.
Mm-hmm. Well, macroeconomically, what about the need for a steady state economy? I guess that would flow naturally from your theory.
Absolutely. So, yes, so the macroeconomic indicators, we can't forget about those, right? Because, and of course, again, there's Herman's work with John Cobb on the GPI. There's Mattis and Bill Rees's work on the ecological footprint. So there have been various attempts to capture at a macroeconomic level that it's not only the output of final goods and services that can be counted, but also we must account for the impact that this production process has. And so you're absolutely right, that has to be a focus. And the question is, how do we do it? Because of course we all know how compelling that one number is that we call GDP, and any of the other indicators are more complex because this is a complex problem.
Mm-hmm. Do any of the causes courses at UDC have a solid dose of steady state economics?
We sure do. One of the courses that actually counts for all three of the concentrations in our PhD program in urban leadership and entrepreneurship, we have three: policy concentration, a sustainability and resilience concentration, and an entrepreneurship concentration. And guess what? Ecological economics, which is one of the courses I teach, counts for all three of those concentrations. And so, yes, students also in our master's programs in water resources management, urban agriculture, and urban sustainability get a good dose of ecological economics and complex systems in those courses.
Oh, that's really encouraging. And I'd like to encourage our young listeners, especially from the DC metro area, to check out UDC and Causes. Remember, that's the College of Agriculture, Urban Sustainability, and Environmental Sciences. And while we're promoting deserving programs like Causes, I think it's time for a short non-commercial break with Rick Tibbetts.
Hey there, Steady Staters. We hope you're enjoying the show. Want to stay up to date on what's happening in the Steady State community? Our blog, The Steady State Herald, is the premier outlet for relevant, timely, and fully informed discussion on steady state economics. We publish new articles every week featuring analysis of topics ranging from economic theory to politics and governance. You can find this and a variety of other informational resources on our website, steadystate.org. Simply pan over to the Track tab and click Steady State Herald in the drop-down menu. Now, back to the show.
Now, we've talked a little about Causes, the College of Agriculture, Urban Sustainability, and Environmental Sciences, and the PhD program you lead there. I assume that's part of Causes, too. But can you tell us about a few of your favorite research projects?
Yes. Well, one of my favorite research projects has been, and it's, again, this intersection you mentioned earlier between research and practice. How do we get that actually implemented? And so one of my favorite projects over these last few years has been to build what we call the UDC Urban Food Hub. And an urban food hub is a hub in an urban community that produces food, processes, distributes, and closes the loop through waste and water management. So you can see here how it is very circular. It could be a real good exemplar for a circular economy concept, which is, of course, one of the concepts that brings these sink functions and not just the sources of production into focus. And so we've actually developed the concept, and we've been building these urban food hubs across Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and when you say food hubs, you're not talking about McDonald's.
I'm talking about urban farms and ideally urban farms that also have kitchen facilities associated with them, or at least a food truck, so the food can also be processed and used to improve nutrition, provide access to healthy unprocessed food in neighborhoods that have no full-service grocery stores. We're also looking at distribution models, because it doesn't have to be a grocery store, right? It could be a community-supported agriculture model of food distribution. And then last but not least, as I said, a lot of activity in this closing the loop, that fourth component of the food hub, where we're looking at how can we recirculate water to reuse it, how can we use nutrients more effectively, how can we enhance soil health and carbon absorption while we're at it in terms of producing and processing food.
Mm-hmm. Well, our listeners probably realize that perpetually increasing accumulation of anything isn't possible, much less good. But what about simply private ownership of the means of production? Can we reconcile that with a steady state economy?
Well, that's a really big question and important question, Brian. And the question, of course, is what institutions do we need to do what? Markets are really efficient allocation mechanisms, but they can't do everything. And so what other institutional models do we need to attend to other parts of this circular economic process? One of the questions is, of course, what does ownership look like? Does it always have to be individual ownership? Sometimes that's simply not realistic, because you may not have the skills, the capacity for one person to be that owner of a new business. And the question becomes, can we envision this differently? Can we pool skills? Can we come up with collaborative and cooperative models that would be much more effective in some of our communities?
Okay, now here's one that might seem to come out of nowhere, but with your particular expertise, I'd hate to lose this opportunity. So can you give us just a basic overview, if that's possible, of input-output analysis? And maybe try to relate it back to ecological footprint accounting and steady state economics?
Mm-hmm. So input-output is really the methodology is, imagine a big matrix. And if you read the rows of the matrix, you have rows of different sectors of the economy. And the same sectors you'll find when you look down the columns of this matrix. And so typically we start with agriculture and forest products and so forth, and then we move into manufacturing, and then the services are to the way right hand or the bottom of the matrix. And so if you look at this as these columns, you'll see that each column draws from other sectors. And so you can describe each of these economic sectors as made up of input flows from other economic sectors. Mm-hmm. And that's what we mean by input-output. And then on the way right-hand side of the matrix, you would have your output. And so it's a very nice way of showing ripple effects through the economy. If you change the output of one sector, how does that then ripple through these other sectors as this one sector draws from all different kinds of sectors? So agriculture draws from manufacturing, from petrochemicals, and so forth. You can imagine how you could visualize these mm-hmm. Different sectors being linked.
Yeah, that seems to be what should be really fundamental to a lot of our ecological economics, micro and macro, frankly. So
absolutely. And then, of course, you have different kinds of input-output. Most use money, so we still use monetary units as the units by which we describe what sector pulls from what other sector. But then you mentioned Matthias Wackernagel and Bill Rees's work. They use actually area. So that could be another reference point. So how much land do we need for these different activities? And then a third way of looking, there's been a lot of input-output work that transfers this money into energy. How much energy do these different sectors draw from other sectors to produce goods and services?
Well, Sabine, what an enlightening program it's been with you today. We definitely covered some new ground for our listeners. Thanks for being our guest, and let's do it again this fall, okay? If not sooner.
My pleasure, Brian. This was a really enjoyable conversation. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, folks, that about wraps her up. We've been talking with Sabine O'Hara, a highly original thinker, scholar, and leader. She's been a mentor to many of her students, too. Dr. O'Hara has held high titles, Dean, Executive Director, ISEE President, and others we never got to. But there's something else about Sabine that really stands out. She clearly wants to make the world a better place, and she works hard at it. Not just for the sake of some abstract world, but for the people on the planet, and especially the folks who haven't been handed a silver platter. Let's all wish her the best and maybe let her example rub off on us as well. I'm Brian Check, and you've been listening to the Steady Stater podcast. See you next time.